Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam X. McNeil, PhD student at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. Today we have Dr. W. Caleb McDaniel, Associate Professor of History at Rice University. Dr. McDaniel is on to discuss his brand new book, Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. And Sweet Taste of Liberty is published by our friends at Oxford University Press. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. And, thank you so much once again for coming on. And, you know, it's been a pleasure reading your book and really being able to see, you know, just an amazing story and a historian, you know, crafting, an amazing story. And so I just really appreciate you for your work. And so before we get into the real bare bones of the book, can you talk to us about how you got to this particular subject?
Sure. Well, the book tells the story of Henrietta Wood, a formerly enslaved woman who was freed before the Civil War, but then was kidnapped and re-enslaved in 1853. And she managed after the Civil War to sue the man who had kidnapped and enslaved her and won the largest known sum of restitution ever awarded by a U.S. court to a formerly enslaved person. And so I first learned about her story from an interview that she gave in 1879 to a small town Ohio newspaper. And I read that back in 2014. At the time, I was actually doing research on a different subject. I was studying enslaved people who were forcibly removed to Texas during the Civil War by Confederate planters who were trying to evade the Emancipation Proclamation and quote-unquote refugee enslaved people to Confederate Texas. And so this interview came to my attention because that was also part of Wood's story. During the Civil War, she was taken to Texas as part of her long ordeal. And so once I started reading about all the twists and turns of her case, though, her story quickly became the one that I was most interested in telling. And I started to try to, you know, follow all the clues that I could from her interview. And it led me to other sources that led to the book.
Outstanding. And so with that, you know, when like what was like the year around when you started to when this all really kind of came together? Because I know that people pick things up and don't always write about them immediately, you know.
Yeah, no, it was in 2014. And I think, the reasons why the story was especially compelling to me at that moment had a lot to do with the timing. That was, of course, during the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. And so there was a lot of conversation among professional historians, but also in the general public about the meaning of the Civil War and a sort of reassessment of some of the jagged edges of the end of the Civil War and the ways that emancipation came and what it left undone was very much a topic of conversation at that time. There was also in the summer of 2014, the article Case for Reparations was published by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic magazine. And so there was a lot of conversation in the public sphere about reparations, cases for it, cases against it. But when I read Henrietta Wood's story, it seemed to me that here potentially was a case of a kind of reparations that might speak to those current debates. And so there was a lot, sort of in the air, I guess, in 2014 in particular, that made me want to know more about her story.
Outstanding. And that's in part why I wondered, you know, how recent, you know, it was. It seemed like that initially. And so with that being said, can you talk to us as well about, you know, what was the archival process for you like for this book?
Well, it was for me a very different process than my first book. My first book was more of a sort of intellectual and cultural history of the abolitionist movement. And in that case, I had, you know, an abundance of sources because the abolitionists wrote and published a lot. And, you know, there was almost the challenge of how to wade through all of their correspondence and publications. You know, in this case, it was much more of a kind of sleuthing effort to try to piece together different parts of the story and follow breadcrumbs and clues, you know, where they led to a source here, a source there. Ultimately, I think there were archives in around 10 states that had little bits of the story, fragments of the archive that I was able to pull together to write this narrative. Of course, it wasn't possible to answer every question that I had about her story, but what amazed me was how much I was able to find, which is really a testament to how detailed her memories were of what had happened in her life. I mentioned that she gave an interview in 1879. She also gave another interview in 1876 to a different reporter. And those two interviews had very detailed memories with names and dates and places that helped me to find sources about the people that she had encountered and the people who had perpetrated these, you know, crimes against her. And then she, of course, also told her story in her lawsuit that we mentioned at the outset. And so a lot of the archival process was starting from those interviews and that lawsuit, and then working out from there using the details in those sources.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this is 2019, and that was 1879. So that would make it, what, 140 years? Wow. Important commemoration too. So it's just a lot of, you know, as historians, we love, you know, commemorations. We love, you know, those round, like we like those numbers that have zeros at the end. They're not always in our bank accounts, but, you know, in our commemorations, we certainly love them. And so one last bit about the archival part too, because it I think comes to a crux of, you know, when you author the story of someone else, right? Were you able to find any of Mrs. Wood's living descendants? Were they, you know, a part of any of this process as well?
Absolutely. And that was actually one of the greatest privileges of working on the book, was being able to meet one of Henrietta Wood's great-great-granddaughters. Was the first descendant I contacted. The book is actually dedicated to her, a woman named Winona Adkins, who unfortunately passed away last year after a battle with colon cancer. But I was able to speak with her and meet with her in person. And she was able to provide me with some photos that are published in the book of family members, including Wood's son, Arthur Sims, who was the great-grandfather of Winona Adkins. And so she actually remembered as a young girl her great-grandfather living in the same house where she grew up in Chicago. And so he died in 1951, and she was born in 1944. So, you know, there was about 6 or 7 years where they lived together in the same house. And, you know, one of the things that that I think really communicates powerfully is how close this history is to us. You know, you mentioned it's 140 years since Wood gave that interview in 1879. But on the other hand, I was able to, you know, speak in Oakland with someone whose lifespan overlapped with the life of Wood's son, who was born enslaved in Mississippi in 1856. And so this isn't a distant history, but, you know, is one that is still close to us in a lot of ways.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, especially during these times when we have these debates about reparations and about, thinking about where we are with that particular conversation, this is why I think that Sweet Taste of Liberty is, you know, not only a great book just on its own, but it's also a very timely book as well, considering, you know, the hearings that happened on Juneteenth earlier this year. And so with that, when it comes to this book, right, you know, you were talking about your previous book on the abolitionist, which I have downstairs in my library. So thank you for that. You know, definitely thank you for that one. But also, can you talk to us about, because you had referenced it briefly in your earlier remarks. If you had to break it down to one, what would have been what was your biggest challenge in writing this book? What would you say was the biggest, like the single biggest challenge that you had with writing this book and crafting
it? Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think you're right that certainly what was happening in the present day was very much on my mind and sort of drew me to the story. And I think, you know, one challenge historians always have is trying to represent the past in a way that is as faithful as possible to the record, you know, and is accountable to the people who lived that history, you know, and speaking to the present without allowing the present to distort that their own story. And so I think that was one challenge of sort of moving in my own mind back and forth between contemporary debates and just trying to understand this particular person's life in her own context. But I think that's, you know, always one of the challenges in particular that historians of slavery face. I know Stephanie Smallwood has talked about writing histories that are accountable to the enslaved, you know, and try as much as possible to tell the story in a way that honors their own experience, their lived experience, and their own reflections on those experiences. And that's, you know, especially challenging in cases where we don't have a lot of information about particular enslaved people. In this case, we had the two interviews that Wood gave. Of course, they were mediated through the interviewers that she spoke with. And we had, you know, her petition to the court. And so on the one hand, it seemed as though I had a lot of sources, but at the same time, I faced the challenge of trying to grapple with what's left out of those sources and what the silences are that still remain in this archival record. And so that was another, I think, big challenge is wanting to do the best that I could with this material that that Wood had left and had wanted to be shared, you know, in these newspaper accounts, and to sort of try to do them justice as some clues about how she herself would have wanted the story to be told, while at the same time also recognizing that that the access that we have to her own perspective is not totally unmediated or perfect by any means.
And with that too, you had mentioned Dr. Stephanie Smallwood and leaning on her statement of writing histories that are accountable to the enslaved. You know, that in part also takes up a question of creativity and the historian's you know, use of, you know, just the creative within themselves. And so how do you think about this story as one of not being created, right? Not in like a novelistic way, but thinking about, you know, what it means to be creative with the story. And especially because, you know, you're talking about the fragmented archive and how Wood did provide a wealth of information and a lot of dates, which is not in many or all stories of formerly enslaved people. So can you talk about that? And also talk to us about, you know, what was something that you thought of when it came to Wood that was just astounding, that you were kind of maybe surprised to find in her story and in the archive?
Sure. Well, I mean, on the first question, I think that, another scholar whose work sort of informed my thinking about this, Cydia Hartman, who's written about the ways that, you know, not everything can be verified in the archives that enslavers left behind about enslaved people. And so if we as historians refuse to take the risk of imagining and trying to think beyond the archive, then we will sort of, you know, allow this archive that was created by enslavers to stand unchallenged. And so, you know, I think in the appendix of the book, I talk a little bit about the gaps that remain in the story about Henrietta Wood, but also the importance of trying to, as Hartman puts it, imagine what cannot be verified. Of course, in a disciplined way that is also accountable to what we know. You know, you don't want to imagine in a way that's not constrained by what else we know about enslaved people's experience and what she herself said in these interviews. But nonetheless, that is a challenge I think historians need to take up in order to try to get to the lived experience of people who endured and survived slavery. In terms of what was surprising about her story, I mean, there was so much that was surprising. she was somebody who I think in her life experienced so many kinds of slavery in so many different places. You know, historians of slavery are aware of how varied enslaved people's experience could be, depending on whether they, you know, lived in an urban setting or in a rural setting in the Deep South or the Upper South, if they worked in households or they worked in the fields, if they were enslaved or free. But all of these parts of the African-American experience in the 19th century, in a way, her story touched on, you know, all of those different areas. And I was just continually surprised by how much time and space her story spanned and how many different places that enabled the narrative to travel to. I was also, I don't want to give away too much of the narrative of the book, but one of the things that was especially amazing to me was she was, like many enslaved people, separated from her family at an early age for the first time. She was sold when she was 14 years old away from the Northern Kentucky farm where she was born and separated from her parents and her siblings there. And so like, you know, most enslaved people whose kinship ties were torn apart by the interstate slave trade, she longed for the opportunity to reunite with family members. And one of the most astonishing moments in the story is when she's able to, as she talks about in one of her interviews, reunite with her mother briefly, although it was under some tragic circumstances. And I was able to, it seemed sort of, you know, so amazing to me as to almost be unbelievable that she could have come across her mother in this setting. But then I was able to find a census record that did place her mother in the place, you know, where she remembered meeting her. And so that was just kind of one of those wow moments where the archive does kind of disclose this amazing, you know, almost unbelievable encounter.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Man, let me tell you too, like when I was reading your book, that was one of the parts that I enjoyed the most about reading Sweet Taste of Liberty is just how well written the book was. Like when I tell you, like being able to just sit back on my couch and just read just the tragic, the riveting, the amazing, the oh my god, like kind of, you know, so it was effective in that way. And so good on you on that one. And also, No problem. It's why my advisor, Dr. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, was like, "You gonna interview?" As she called you, not me. As she called you, "You gonna interview Caleb?" I was like, "Yeah." She was happy about that. Hey, Dr. Dunbar, I know you're listening. But you know, one of the other parts that you had just mentioned, and this goes to the relevance, the multifocal relevance of the story. You talked about family separations, and obviously, you know, that is something that is very much on the mind of many Americans, you know, in this country. And so, you know, that was another part that I thought was astounding, was just seeing all the different ways of how your book, though you are not trying to, you know, you're not trying to exclusively speak to the present, there's so many different ways that your book interrogates the present.
I think that's less a testament to my book and more to just the ways that the legacies of so much of this history lives on, so that it's hard not to see these resonances between the past and the present. I think that's, you know, one of the things that projects like the 1619 Project have done so effectively is to. And the abolitionists kind of did this too. William Lloyd Garrison would often in the Liberator publish, two stories side by side and say, "Look on this picture, and on this," you know. And I think that's kind of what some of these projects and hopefully parts of the story do, is without necessarily overlooking the discontinuities or differences between things in the past and the present. That when you look on this picture and then you look on this, it's hard not to see parallels and echoes.
Absolutely. And another question that I have for you in regards to the story, especially, you know, thinking about what it means, you know, what are some of like the meanings of this story that you take out as the author of this particular story? This present book is done because I have it and the world has it. And you're going on this stupendous tour of places that I'm looking at right now. I have the list right now. You have gone to Brazos Bookstore in Houston. You've gone to Book People in Austin, Octavia Books in New Orleans, and the list goes on. How has this story changed you as a person, if you don't mind bringing, you know, your personal self slightly into the story?
Well, that's a big question. I think it's probably one of those things that I'm still learning, you know, and as time passes, I'll be able to look back and reflect on it. I mean, it's been a powerful experience to talk about the story to a lot of different audiences. And one of the questions that they have is about sort of what the lessons are for today. And I talk about this a little bit in the epilogue of the book. I want, you know, sort of readers of the story, I don't want to necessarily tell readers what they should conclude. I try to leave the questions open for readers to reflect on. But I think, you know, in our current day debates about reparations, as you mentioned, there was the hearings this summer in Congress about it. I think a couple of things that this story can contribute to those debates is, first of all, just an awareness of how long the struggle for reparations has been, that is not sort of a recent struggle. Of course, this is something that scholars of African-American history know well, but the general public, I don't think, is as aware of just how long and deep and wide this tradition is, stretching back to the post-revolutionary period with women like Belinda Sutton, who sued her owner's estate for a pension, and continuing on to Callie House in the late 19th century, leading a grassroots movement for ex-slave pensions from the government. And then, of course, continuing into the long 20th century history of the struggle for reparations. I think, you know, what Henrietta Wood's story shows is that formerly enslaved people and enslaved people from the earliest possible moment have articulated the justice of restitutionary claims from slavery. And that in itself is sort of important to stress in the public debates. And I think the other lesson it that I came away with, I mentioned earlier meeting one of the descendants of Henrietta Wood who knew her great-grandfather, Arthur Sims. And I think learning about Sims was actually one of the moments that convinced me that there could be a book here as opposed to an article or a smaller piece of writing, because Sims, as I mentioned, lived into his 90s and died in Chicago in 1951 after he had practiced law on the South Side of Chicago for around 50 years. And that's because he was able to become one of the first African-American graduates of Northwestern University's law school back in the 1880s. So his story of moving to Chicago after Wood's victory against Zebulon Ward in this lawsuit for restitution really shows the differences that the judgment made in the life of her family. So I think on the one hand, the amount that she won, I can't remember if I've mentioned it yet, you know, she won $2,500 from this lawsuit, which was only a fraction of the $20,000 she had asked for from the court. But it was nonetheless a significant amount of money, worth approximately $60,000 to $65,000 in today's currency. And that money enabled, I believe, her son to purchase a house in Chicago at a time when homeownership was extremely rare for anyone, and especially for African Americans in Chicago at that time. And then that house became an asset that he used to help fund his legal education and set his own family onto a path into the middle class. So, you know, in some respects, her story and his story offers a kind of narrative about what might have been in a place like Chicago for families had there been more wealth at the beginning in the immediate aftermath of emancipation. But at the same time, if you look at that larger context in which he lived on the South Side of Chicago with redlining and housing discrimination and mass incarceration and the kind of continued oppressions that form the basis for many contemporary cases for reparations, you know, then one has to wonder how much did Wood win? You know, she certainly for her own family did make a big difference, but there's also all of these other people and stories that don't end as well.
Yeah, and that's the part that I'm brushing up against with my work on the American Revolution. And, you know, was the war revolutionary for the masses of Black folks? And I say no, but that doesn't foreclose upon the success of, you know, the tens of thousands of individuals who were able to be liberated and gain freedom, largely through the British, but not exclusively. And it's trying to, like, you know, like, you're authoring a story of a individual. And so the question is always, like, how much do we put into the lasting meanings of their of their situation? And it's like, you know, it's tough, but, you know, it's why it's better that we have these books out into the world. Thank you, Dr. McDaniel, so that we can, you know, bring all the stories into the light. And and I have one other question too. So you had mentioned Zebulon Ward, and you know, what a dastardly, I don't want to say devil, but I think I just said it. And so, you know, have you encountered any of his descendants with this story too? Because then you have that other part of the present too. That's that you're not only talking about Mrs. Ward, but you're also talking about, you know, this other part too.
You know, I didn't have as much success connecting with descendants of Zebulon Ward. Although, you know, and I think it's clear that, and this is another way of thinking about the significance of her victory, that while the $2,500 was a significant amount for her and Sims and their family, it was a drop in the bucket of what Ward could have afforded to pay. By the end of his life, he had made multiple fortunes, largely through becoming a pioneer of convict leasing regimes. In the American South, he managed the penitentiaries in antebellum Kentucky. And then after the Civil War, he was the keeper of the state penitentiary in Tennessee and then in Arkansas. So he made a huge amount of money in those positions, so much that by the time he died in the 1890s, he left behind an estate to his family worth at least $600,000. So that made, you know, him kind of a multimillionaire in today's terms. And so I do think, you know, if you sort of, you certainly could weigh the gains that Wood's family made alongside, Ward's family and what that wealth would have meant, for his family and descendants. But I also think too, that, you know, today's, arguments about reparations often focus less on the wealth of individual families and slaveholders' descendants, and really shifting the conversation more to the complicity of the federal government and state governments in maintaining slavery and Jim Crow and segregation over a long period of time. And so I don't know as much about Zebulon Ward's descendants, but I also think that, you know, in some ways maybe that will prevent readers from thinking that, you know, this story is largely about trying to sort of settle up individual debts between individual families. I think really what the story points to by the end of it, if you think about convict leasing and the role that the state played in systems like that, you know, that really what we need to think about are these, you know, these systemic investments that that governments have made in white supremacy over many generations, and how can we repair that through some system of reparations in the present.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Could not have said it better myself, and I didn't, because I'm not the one who wrote the book. So there we go. And and I had misspoke. I said Mrs. Ward. It's Mrs. Wood. Just want to make sure the record gets that one, so I don't think I'm out here just you know, dilly-dallying out here.
Well, it was confusing. I did find, you know, their names are so similar, Wood and Ward.
Yeah,
and Ward. That was kind of one challenge of writing the book, you know, in a copy editing stage. I was definitely, you know, trying to make absolutely sure that there was no, slip of confusing the two.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, you definitely don't want to do that. And I've done talks before, and I'm like, oh shoot, did I just really and you never remember it in the moment. Usually, it's usually like after the Q&A is over, and you're like, shoot, they put this on record. And so, you know, in the last couple minutes that we have you, can you talk to us, you know, now that, you know, Sweet Taste of Liberty, you know, like I said, it's out to the world, you know, we're reading it, we're interviewing it for it, you know, you're going on this awesome tour. You know, do you have anything in the works for, you know, maybe round three of your time with New Books, with the New Books Network?
You know, I'm still very much in the midst of this book, so I haven't thought too much about what's next. Although, you know, there are some aspects of this story that I think still intrigue me that I'd like to research further. You know, as I've read Mary Frances Berry's book about Callie House and the struggle for reparations in the late 19th century, I do think that there's a lot more that could be said about sort of the period between Henrietta Wood in the 1870s and Callie House at the turn of the century. So I am a little bit interested in kind of diving more into debates about reparations in that period. It's one question that I often get is, you know, how did people react to Wood's victory at the time? And certainly there was a lot of newspaper commentary, even in national outlets like the New York Times, that were sort of reflecting on the significance and the meaning of her victory. But I would like to know more about sort of the discourse around restitution and reparations during Reconstruction and immediately after Reconstruction. And one interesting thing that I found in reading the coverage of Wood's case is how often the question of compensation to former slaveholders got sort of tied up together with the question of restitution or compensation to formerly enslaved people, that these two topics, even though, you know, they're obviously conceptually distinct, in the discourse of that time were often, you know, bound up together in newspaper editorials and in even in some early kind of proposals for reparations, included some idea of compensation as well to former enslavers. And so that's something that interests me a little bit, is thinking about kind of the long history of movements for compensation to slaveholders alongside the movement for reparations, and why it is that those two things were often talked about sort of in the same breath or in the same spaces.
And actually, do you have a few more minutes? I do have one last question. Okay. Now this is one that would be more fun. So if you had a chance to sit down with Henrietta Wood and her descendants, specifically her son, right? You had them, you were able to resurrect them from the dead for a 5-course meal in Chicago, wherever y'all want, right? And you had a chance to ask them anything under the sun, any question or questions. Let's just say you get 3 questions, right? That they have to answer, right? They have to answer. What do you think? What would you choose, right?
Wow, that's a heavy question. You know, obviously, you know, any historian or someone who spends a lot of time with a particular historical figure, I'm sure would want to know how they did. You know, did they capture effectively enough what that person was going through? I'm sure in many ways I haven't. But that would be, you know, a topic of conversation, I'm sure. I think one of the big questions for me at the end of the story is not being 100% sure how Wood herself thought about her victory. You know, the archival trail stops in a way after she wins. And even that 1879 interview where we started, at the end of that interview, she was still waiting for the payments from Ward. As she put it, she was waiting for him to, quote, pass over them checks. And I was, of course, later able to confirm that he did in the court record. But one thing that that I'm not able to show from the archive is what her reaction to the amount that she won was. Did she view it as, you know, sort of pittance, or did she view it as a significant victory? You know, that's something that I would certainly want to ask, you know, because on the one hand, the money I think did make a difference for her son's life. A lot of that is sort of my interpolating into the evidence in a way that I would want to know from them how they thought about this victory. It's kind of interesting to me that the family descendants that I've spoken with didn't have a lot of recollection of Wood's victory. One of them knew about the lawsuit, but had not been aware of the victory or the amount that had been won, and didn't even know that Arthur Sims had been born enslaved. And so that raises questions for me about how the story got told and passed down across generations, and what they emphasized or didn't emphasize, and why. You know, what does that say about how they themselves viewed this legal victory? You know, in a larger sense, did they view it as a substantive victory that played a role in their own family's history?
Wow, amazing. Amazing. And y'all, we have had the amazing opportunity to have this amazing author at Rice University. His name is Dr. W. Caleb McDaniel, Associate Professor of History at Rice University. And Dr. McDaniel has been on to discuss his phenomenal book, published by Oxford University Press, entitled Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. And y'all, please go get this book. Please support our authors. And if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy New Books in African American Studies, please rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts, because you always want to know how we are doing. And I'll just say it for myself, negatively or positively. I just want to know how you think we're doing here. Once again, please go get this book. Please support our authors. And once again, folks, I am so happy. This is actually my 55th interview in the last 2 years.
That's great.
And thank you. And it has been a pleasure. And I'm not saying this because I'm going to say that I'm done. It's only getting started. It's only getting started. We got a lot of great content coming towards you. And we have some more hosts coming on the program, too. So if you like my voice, believe me, I have to recruit some of them. You're going to love their voices and their stories and their interviews as well. And so, folks, I am your host, your co-host of the channel for today, PhD student at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, Adam McNeil from New Books in African American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Over and out.